Hello.
My name is Isaac Brickman, and welcome to Office Hours. Each episode, I will talk to a professor about a topic that is relevant to you. On each show, the guest will have a different perspective on the topic. The goal is twofold. First, I want to make academia more accessible, applicable, and exciting to everyone, including non-academic audiences. I also want to help dissolve the boundaries between disciplines by taking a more holistic approach to learning. Our first topic is social media, and I'm excited to have Ethan Zuckerman on the show to talk about it. Ethan is an associate communications, computer science, and public policy professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He was an affiliate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, former director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT, a TED Talker, author, and regretful inventor of the pop-up ad. His crowning achievement, however, is being my thesis advisor. Welcome to the show, Ethan.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Isaac. And actually, we're also co-authors. We've written some things together. We've got a chapter coming out in a book coming out of Yale. So lots of different things that we've done together.
Yeah, and I'm excited to get into that chapter a little bit later with you. But I want to start on what my thesis pitch was originally to you a couple years ago. And that was really about social media and the harmful effects it can have on mental health, especially teenage girls' mental health. And I first came to you being inspired by Jonathan Haidt's famous and controversial book, The Anxious Generation, which talked about how social media is harmful to childhood development. You saw social media differently and told me to read It's Complicated by Dana Boyd. That book talks about how social media can be really useful, actually, for teens' mental health because, you know, basically it's a tool for teens to connect in a way that they can't connect in the offline world. And after reading both books, I came to this nuance understanding that social media can be helpful, harmful, and everything in between. And I wanted to expand upon that nuance with you a little bit. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you once told me that there are three major buckets that social media impacts: the self, relationships, and democracy. Can you tell me why these are the paradigms where social media is studied?
Sure. So you got a lot in there, Isaac. So I'm going to actually back up a little bit to those two fascinating and excellent books. Haidt's book is looking, I think, in many ways at the extremes of social media, which is to say that when we look at people who have very bad reactions to social media, people who end up bullied, people who end up having real negative body image, who end up harmed by social media, these things are real, and we don't want to deny them. The trick is most people are in fact not harmed by social media, and as Boyd manages to explain in It's Complicated, and you know, great title for that book, for most people, social media either doesn't have a lot of effect on them or has some positive effects, some positive socializing effects. And there's groups of people who might be marginalized in daily life, queer teens, weird, geeky teens like I was, for whom social media ends up being incredibly important and incredibly helpful. So the cool thing about those two books is that they can both be right. You can actually have social media that's quite dangerous for some people and that we need to address it, but also quite positive for a lot of people. And we need to find solutions to problems of social media that don't sell out all the people who are having good experiences at in the hopes of helping people who are having very bad experiences. I find that whenever we talk about social media, we blur lots of things together. So I like to unpack into a couple of different buckets. Social media has very personal effects. If you're wrestling with body image, if you're wrestling with your weight or your body image, social media might be intensely difficult for you. You might end up spending a lot of time on Instagram, seeing people with particularly, manifestations of body. You might end up spending a lot of time scrolling and, sort of obsessing over things. There's also positive versions. You might end up exploring gender identity in a way that ends up being very positive for you and finding those resources online. But there's a set of problems that we might think of as being about body image, about internet addiction. They're sort of deeply psychological and they're sort of one-on-one. There's a second group of problems about how internet interacts with groups. How does it deal with group dynamics? There are healthy groups and there are less healthy groups. Almost anyone who's ever been part of a group online understands the disinhibition effect. People can be much nastier, much meaner in online spaces. There's actually good psychological reasons for this. There's lots of feedback that we don't get back. We don't have the eye contact. We don't have the micro expressions and such about things that we're talking about. And then there's the third level, which is the internet, is the way that news is being shaped, the way that memes are being spread, the way that mis and disinformation is going back and forth, is this starting to erode democracy? And you're not going to be surprised that for me, I'm going to tell you yes and no. There's ways in which the internet can be very positive and lots of ways in which the internet can be negative. But I think grouping it into those categories, rather than dealing with is social media good or bad, we can then dig down and try to deal with one of the subgroups.
Yeah, I think it's a lot easier conceptually to look at it based on those sort of subgroups and all at the same time. And looking at the self too for a second, I think it's very interesting how you say it affects everybody in different ways, because it affected me in all the different ways. In 2020, I was a little bit more insecure about myself, and social media was very hard for me, especially during the pandemic, seeing all these kids who I thought had better lives than I did, right? And it turns out that no, they didn't. They're also having a hard time. But, when you're 18, it's hard to sort of understand that as much. And social media has also been, just a place that I go, and it really didn't mean anything to me. And it's also been a place where I really sort of found communities. I used to have a sports account, a fan sports account for the Celtics, my favorite team. I used to have an art account where I'd post all my art, and those accounts were really fun because it engaged with those communities in a really deep and meaningful way. And sorry, you could go.
Oh, I love the way that you're talking about this, Isaac, because it's a very multifaceted version of this. And I think one of the problems that we have with social media is that we tend to treat it all as one thing. I interact quite differently with people on Facebook than I do on Instagram, than I do on Mastodon, than I do on Blue Sky. And, those are just the ones that I choose to engage on. We're complex human beings. We contain multitudes. Social media actually makes it possible to sort of explore those multitudes. There's a way in which we talk about social media, which is a very totalizing discourse. And so I think doing something like you're doing here, where you're essentially saying, I have a lot of different selves on social media, and I've had both those positives and those negatives, I think it's just a great first step in having a more thorough and more complete dialogue about what social media is and what it can do.
Yeah, I want to get into social media and relationships for a second. Not necessarily the most positive things that social media can do for relationships, but we know that that social media can bring people together. We've seen that with you reconnecting with your wife through Facebook. But social media doesn't always do that. It can also tear people apart, as we touched on a little bit. And a lot of this has to do with the algorithms that these major platforms use, which incentivize extreme content, misinformation, and disinformation. And I wanted to ask you why platforms do this and how it can harm the way that people communicate with each other.
So let's start by saying that this is a hypothesis. I actually think it's a hypothesis that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a hypothesis that we can demonstrate a decent amount of validity and support for. But it is a hypothesis, and the hypothesis basically says most social media has an algorithm that is making choices about what you are likely to see. On most platforms, you can override this algorithm. Even on Facebook, you can go in and go through a whole bunch of settings and set it to just give me posts in chronological order. But social platforms really prefer selecting through posts and giving you ones that it thinks that you're going to engage with. At the end of the day, engagement promotes the business model. If you are posting on a site, if you're replying to people, if you are engaged in conversation, you are demonstrably more likely to return to that site and to continue spending time on that site. And that means that you will be present to view and potentially click on more ads. So there's a pretty strong commercial incentive to keep you engaged with a site. So people who want to use social media very lightly and just kind of dip in, check things out, and then move on, the platforms have incentives that are counter to that. They really want you to stick around for a while. Within that, people then hypothesize social media platforms have figured out that highly emotional content, and this could be someone engaging with intense happiness or intense sadness in their life, is likely to get high degrees of engagement. And they've sort of extrapolated further to this idea that content that is rage bait or outrage bait, either it really makes you pissed off or it makes you skeptical and sort of want to engage with it. Is this really true? That these create engagement. I don't know that I fully buy this. I actually think that people have gotten quite used to being manipulated in certain ways, and I think often are turning away from some of this content. But I think what's happening is that people are trying to say, wow, I am having content presented to me in certain ways. Those ways are not about my priorities, they're about the platform's priorities. And let's be clear, that doesn't feel great. How do we navigate that complicated equation? And I think that question of this doesn't feel great, how do we navigate it? I think that's a great starting point for how people deal with algorithms on social media.
And to make this problem a little bit more complicated for you, I wanted to add in the variable of content moderation, particularly how does ineffective content moderation make these algorithms that, possibly exploit misinformation, disinformation, extreme content that gets more engagement? How does ineffective content moderation make that stuff worse?
Sure. So we often think about social media platforms as sort of having layers to them. So someone tries to post something to a social media platform, and the first layer is moderation. Are we going to allow that on the platform or not? And so the flat out, sorry, you can't post that there, that's often a moderation decision. Facebook, for instance, is pretty aggressive about nudity, and will even take down artistic nudity, things along those lines. Some platforms are pretty aggressive about hate speech. You need moderation because an unmoderated platform tends to gravitate towards really harmful, really hateful stuff very, very quickly. And people who are marginalized in one fashion or another, racial minorities, women tend to be, queer people tend to be attacked a lot more often. Then there is the sort of algorithmic filtering, which is something made it onto the platform. How likely are you to see it or not see it? And those two things can get blurry. Some platforms deal with edgy content by saying, well, we'll allow it on the platform, but we'll downrank it. You're less likely to get it in your feed. There may be other platforms, I think X right now may be upranking that stuff. It may be essentially saying, in Elon Musk's spirit of free speech and controversy, he may just be looking for the edgiest stuff out there and sort of finding a way to put it out there. But there's scholars like Tarleton Gillespie who basically say, without moderation, you don't have a platform. You can't have the full equation, which is people providing a service, supporting it through advertising, trying to build a community without doing that basic content moderation work, even if that work is, surprisingly difficult, surprisingly controversial.
All right. And we touched on the self a little bit. We touched on the relationship bucket a little bit. And I want to get to our last bucket, which is democracy, which is, I think, is a little bit of your wheelhouse because you teach a class called Defending Democracy in a Digital World. Can you tell me a little bit about how that class is structured?
It is a super fun class, and I have to say, I am hugely looking forward to teaching at the moment because it is such a peculiar moment for American democracy. Basically, I try to make the argument that central to American democracy is media. And the reason that media is central to American democracy is that we are not Athens. America tried to have a participatory democracy in the model of Athenian democracy, but rather than being a city where we could all get together in the agora, we were this enormous set of colonies spread from Boston to Charleston, about 1,200 miles. And we had to use technology to find a way to have a national conversation. And that technology in the late 1700s was postal mail and newspapers. And if you go back and look at the history of the United States, we actually invested incredibly heavily in those systems. We put huge amounts of national wealth into building a robust postal system. And we did it because we couldn't imagine doing a democracy without it. Our democracy now has sort of pillars of commercially provided news and social media spaces of one fashion or another. We are shrinking from physical spaces where people interact with one another. We tend to be moving to digital spaces. That's been happening for at least 30 or 40 years. But it's really accelerated with your generation, where a lot of your political interaction, your social interaction is digitally mediated in one fashion or another. Both the world of news and the world of social media have some real serious problems right now. They are not necessarily serving democracy super well, and they're changing really, really fast. And so our class tries to look at this thousands of year history from Athens through the early Americas, through things like the Fairness Doctrine, and trying to figure out how to have broadcast and balance up to the current day. But we're cross-cutting back and forth between what's going on in the Trump administration at the same time. We literally have a president who has his own social media platform. One of his leading advisors has one of the most powerful social media platforms on the planet. We really have incorporated interactive media right into the heart of governance in ways that we absolutely need to engage with.
I think one pattern that we can learn from your class about how, democracy has sort of shifted from the Athenian age to the modern age is that we have more and more information that is occupying the media space. Sometimes I feel very overwhelmed with the amount of things I see. And I read a book called Nexus by Yuval Noah Harari. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but basically he says that information is not inherently a good thing or a bad thing. Information is information, and having more information isn't necessarily a positive thing for our democracy. So do you think that, in this digital age of information, having this amount of content is ultimately good or bad for our democracy?
I'm going to pull the old card for a moment here and just kind of remind you what things looked like 30 or 40 years ago. So I have this odd experience. I live pretty close to my college town. And in the summers, I actually hang out at the college library that I spent an enormous amount of my undergraduate career in. And I now sit in that library with my laptop and access the internet and enjoy the air conditioning, and enjoy just working in a nice, quiet space. But at the time, that library was where I needed to go to answer a difficult, complex question. So if I wanted to know about the Post Office Act of 1792, I would have to find someone who wrote a book on it. And then I would have to scan through that book and find the information that I wanted. And I would have that information, but it wasn't necessarily that everyone else would have that information. These days, I go to Wikipedia, I get a superficial version of it, I might read a couple of articles on it. Maybe eventually I find a book that I want to do a deep dive into and go into the library. But my relationship to that library is totally, totally different. I am able to get casual information so much faster, right at my fingertips. You have no idea, Isaac, like how much of my high school and college years we would spend sitting around tables arguing about dumb stuff that we would just look at on Wikipedia these days. So the availability of information for people of my generation, for Gen Xers, is this enormous transformation. And it's hard for us to see it as anything other than an unalloyed good. You've grown up in an environment where there's an enormous surplus of information. You're drowning in it. If anything, one of the big things you have to figure out as a young person is a healthy information diet, how you can not drown in the brain rot or, the clickbait or so on and so forth. And so it's just a very different set of relationship to information. It's more like responsible eating. But it's kind of the difference between, my grandparents growing up in the Depression were worried about having enough food. And in terms of information, that's kind of where the Gen Xers were, right? It was really hard to even get information. Now you have, the infinite salad bar, and now the question is trying to figure out how to eat responsibly. I don't know that it's turning out to be very good for democracy. For many of my friends who study this issue, what we're finding is that we're losing anchor institutions. And I'll give you kind of a key example of this. My friend Taylor Owen studies Canadian online media, and he's been sort of waiting for the wall to break. So, Canada had a pretty good election in 2020. Because he says of CBC, the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, it still had enough audience, it still had enough influence that at the end of the day, people would go out and pick up all sorts of information, but they kind of use CBC as a check of what's true and what's not. Now CBC has less of an audience, it has less appeal, people are finding more sort of conspiratorial media online, and his failing is that Canada is having a harder and harder time having a functioning democracy. I think in the United States, we are well past that point. I think we have so much information that we are able to choose information that makes us comfortable and makes us happy, but might make it essentially impossible for us to have meaningful conversations with someone who is interacting with very different media. And I think that's extremely challenging and extremely dangerous.
One related concern to the intersection between the public sphere and social media, I think is really the First Amendment, specifically what voice people should be allowed to have in the online world. And I think we kind of touched on this too, but this voice shouldn't just be, I will say whatever I want all the time. There are concerns to weigh with speech. And one concern is national security, and that has been playing out in the TikTok case. I don't want to get too deep on TikTok, but I think what is essential for our conversation is that the US government thought that users' rights to speech on TikTok is legitimately outweighed by the fear that China could influence users and have access to their data. And you laid out why you disagreed with this ban in an Atlantic article titled, published earlier this year, titled America is No Longer the Home of the Free Internet. Why has America shifted on its attitude towards free speech? And why is this shift a bad thing when it comes to the TikTok ban?
So I find the TikTok ban incredibly frustrating and dispiriting. I find it so strange that Americans are sort of looking at a platform and saying, this speech is so dangerous that the US has a legitimate interest in cutting it off because we can't figure out how to protect ourselves from it. And one of the reasons I find it so strange is that we have case law protecting people's rights to receive, newsletters from the Communist Party of China. Much more explicit propaganda than anything that we're sort of seeing from TikTok. I think what's happened with TikTok is this combination of fear over social media, some of which is legitimate. Fear about China, which, the left and the right in the US, maybe the only thing that they can agree on is that they're worried about being eclipsed by China. And fear of youth, right? TikTok is a medium that is more popular with young people than it is with older people. And one of the things that we've seen through history is that people love focusing on corruption of the youth rather than looking at things that we know are manipulating public opinion like Fox News. The problem with TikTok in some ways is that the national security argument clearly doesn't hold water. If it did, you would not see the Trump administration extending this period again and again and again. And that, basically proves that the argument just doesn't hold, right? If there were legitimate national security concerns, you wouldn't see the Trump administration just sort of saying, yeah, you know what, we'll just keep this going. And so what's happening instead is it's economic protectionism, it's Sinophobia. And what I found so peculiar about it is that when I started working on the internet, there was this very conscious, we've got freedom of speech in the United States. We should advocate for freedom of expression around the world. We should demonstrate that US platforms are great platforms to use for freedom of expression. And now we're literally cutting off one of those platforms due to very poorly supported concerns. So that piece for me was just one of my incredible disappointments. Just a moment where I found myself kind of looking at the world that we're living in right now, looking at the country that we're in, instead of going, this is not what I thought I signed up for.
Yeah, I think a theme pervading this whole conversation has really been that social media, like most technology, can be good and it can be not so good and it can be everything in between. And I think a way that we can take out some of the not so good parts and keep the good parts is giving people agency over their own experience. So why is user control over a platform so crucial to this, so crucial to taking the worst parts out of the social media equation without hurting what makes social media so great, which is connections and community.
So we talked a little bit about this idea that we've moved from social interaction in sort of public spaces to social interaction in digital spaces. So, let's go back in time and maybe most of our social interactions 40 or 50 years ago, they're in, the college dining hall, they're in the church, they're in the bowling league, they're in the social club of one fashion or another. In almost all of those cases, we actually have a role in managing those spaces. Even if we don't run the college dining hall, the people who decide what's going to get talked about around the dinner table are the people around the dinner table. Most churches have some sort of leadership from their community. Most social clubs, whether it's a bowling league or the Elks Club, are run by their members. The rules for digital spaces are being made by lawyers at trillion-dollar companies. And we're losing that ability to shape our spaces. We're losing that ability, all of those sort of soft skills of learning how to be involved with governance, learning how to run a democracy day to day. So finding a way to have more control over our social media spaces would be a really good way forward. If we could look at this and sort of say, hey, I think I'm hearing too much from left-leaning academic types in the Northeast. I really want to choose to diversify my social media feed and hear some different things. I would be starting to take responsibility for my information environment. I would start to take some control over it. I might think about, do I create a discussion space where I have people who have some areas of agreement and areas of disagreement where we can talk together and work forward? One way or another, I would be moving away from this world in which these decisions are entirely made by the corporations and quite possibly based around values that I don't hold, like maximizing shareholder value.
So let's pretend for a second that I didn't write my thesis on middleware, and I know nothing about middleware. Can you talk to me about how middleware factors into this user control equation?
Sure. So, in a perfect world, Facebook would give you the tools to allow you to sort of say, hey, introduce me to some more conservatives and let me turn down the amount of content that I'm getting from academic lefties from New England. Facebook doesn't. They actually don't provide very fine-grained controls, and the controls that they do provide are pretty heavily buried away. But imagine someone comes out there and says, hey, Ethan, I bet a lot of people would like to turn up their ideological diversity. I've written a piece of software, plug it into Facebook, and you've got finer grained control over your ideological diversity. I would be interested in that piece of software. That's an example of middleware. Middleware is software from a third party. I.e., it's not something that you wrote, it's not something that the platform wrote, it's someone else, that gives you increased control over your social media experience. This might be something that makes social media safer. So, this might be something that lets you minimize harassment if you're experiencing a lot of harassment online. It might be something that lets you diversify what you're getting in an algorithmic feed by filtering in or filtering out content associated with it. It might be something that gives you powers that you would like to get out of the platform, a sense for the impact of your content, how it's spreading, things along those lines. What you and I ended up working on in the year that we worked together was documenting middleware as a real lived experience, rather than just a theory. There's a bunch of people sort of coming around to this idea that middleware is great, we should really try it. But you and I were actually able to demonstrate that there actually are lots of people building and using middleware, much of which is great and some of which is problematic, and that we should talk through it.
Yeah, and we did find a lot of middleware examples with a lot of diverse affordances for sure. And I don't think middleware is necessarily how do you say it? Like a all-in-one solution, I guess. I think there are some definite problems that we have seen when documenting middleware. There are some middleware applications that kind of don't necessarily have the best affordances for users, for the community that the users are interacting on. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those use cases of middleware, particularly Grayjay, that might not be the best for building healthy communities online?
So we spent, I'm going to say 40% of the year that we worked together working on this one case study of Grayjay, which is a piece of software that lets you aggregate content from across different video hosting platforms. And Grayjay is designed with a very particular point of view. The idea is the people who build Grayjay are really not fans of YouTube and video hosting platforms. They don't like the idea that creators are compensated through the ad economy. They'd like to see people compensating creators directly. So they sort of envision a system where you're supporting a creator via Patreon as being fairer than one where you're supporting them indirectly through ad sales. And hey, fair enough, and an ad-based internet is probably not my favorite thing either. What's tricky about it is that there's no choice involved with the system for the people who are creating videos. If you're using Grayjay, it just turns off the ads on YouTube and you just get the video straight up. You rely on the user to do the right thing, support the creator via Patreon, but there's no guarantee it's going to happen. And that creator in the first place had the ability to say, I want to be on YouTube, or maybe I don't want to be on YouTube. That creator has the ability to say, you know what, I'm only going to make my content available on Patreon only to people who are subscribing to it. What they're doing through this software is basically sort of saying, we really want to bring about a different economy, but they are the ones sort of choosing the way that that economy works rather than the people who are actually creating content. And that to me feels deeply problematic.
Yeah. Well, we talked about social media a lot, and I want to end by getting away from social media for a minute. And I'm going to give you, and this is a tentative name, a quiz called the Google the Professor quiz.
I love it. I love that I get to be the alpha user on this.
Yes, and you are the first case study of this, and we'll see if this is good enough to be continued after this episode. So, my first question for you is, what is Geek Corpse, and what were they doing in Mali?
So, Geek Core. Not Geek Corpse. We actually tried very hard not to have any Geek Corpses. So from 1999 through 2004, I ran an NGO that helped people from the US, European, occasionally South American tech industries come work in the Global South for 3 to 6 months at a time, and transfer some of their knowledge to people, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa. One of our most exciting programs was in Mali, where we did a lot of networking, wireless point to point. And this stuff was super fun because you do it by like making antennas out of soda bottles and pointing them over stretches of the Malian desert and helping people get on the internet. So this is work that, I had the pleasure of doing for about 5 years. Some of it was supported with money that I made from my life as a startup founder. Some of it was supported by U.S. Agency for International Development, which leaves me very sad about the attacks on that institution, because it was pretty cool to have the chance to give students access to Wikipedia in French and Bambara in rural Malian communities.
That sounds incredibly interesting. That is definitely very, very cool. Second question for you. There's a 2015 documentary about internet privacy called Do Not Track. The documentary interviewed Dana Boyd, Ethan Zuckerman, Kate Crawford, Alicia Garza, and one more person. Who was he?
Oh my gosh. Who was he in 2015? Was it Assange? Did they do Assange virtually on it?
It was Cory Doctorow.
Oh, they got Corey as well. Okay, cool.
And who is Cory?
Oh, Corey Doctorow is definitely not Julian Assange. Corey Doctorow is maybe the most productive human being I know. He is an extremely successful science fiction author. He's a terrific speculative fiction author who also happens to be one of the smartest, most thoughtful sort of tech policy critics. He's responsible, perhaps most recently, for a lot of discourse around enshittification, which is this idea that platforms, particularly two-sided marketplaces like Amazon, are just getting worse and worse and worse as they start betraying both their customers and their sellers. But he's just one of these people who's stupid smart and manages to channel that stupid smart into lots and lots of brilliant writing. And if he weren't my dear friend, I would completely hate him for it.
Okay, third question. You did a Fulbright scholarship in Accra, Ghana. What is the name of the closest capital city of a neighboring country to Accra, Ghana?
It's going to have to be Lomé, Togo,
Yes.
because Togo's really close by. And my guess is that Benin's capital is also pretty close by, but obviously Lomé is going to be closer. I'll tell you the funny thing. When I lived in Accra, I didn't travel much in the region on that trip. We would occasionally go up and see friends pretty far in the north of the country. And one night we ran out of beer. And so we went for a walk to find more beer and found ourselves drinking beer with French labels and suddenly realized that in the middle of the night we had walked over the border from Ghana into Togo, which was just one of those moments of sort of realizing how silly borders are, right? I mean, we went from people who were speaking Ewe to people who were speaking Ewe, and the only thing that changed was whether we were drinking club beer or beer Benin. So no passports were involved, and I was not deported. But yes, Accra is a lovely city, possibly even lovelier now than it was when I was living there in '93 and '94.
Well, thank God you weren't deported. Final question for you. What is your favorite podcast besides this one, of course?
Oh, well, I'm really excited to have had the chance to start out with this one. I'm going to go right now with the podcast that I am most waiting for the next episode of, which is What Trump Can Teach Us About Constitutional Law. That's a podcast produced by Roman Mars, who puts together 99% Invisible, an amazing design podcast. But the star of that podcast is Elizabeth Joh, who is a constitutional scholar who just does this beautiful job of looking at what's going on in the news and giving us the context of constitutional law around it. And I think it's probably just the most valuable thing available podcast-wise at the moment. No offense to your podcast or to my podcast either, which still has one or two more episodes in it before we finally put it to bed.
Well, I did say besides this one, I will give you a 100% on the quiz. Congratulations. You got every question right.
I'm sorry I missed Corey, but at least I know who he is. And I think
Oh
the
yeah,
quiz is great.
that.
I think that's I think that'll be a super fun feature going forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ethan, for coming on the show and giving us some insight on the complexities that surround such a crucial technology in this wide-ranging conversation.
Isaac, it's an honor and a pleasure, and I wish you all the best with the podcast. I think it's a great way of trying to take some of the professors that you and others are having the chance to learn from and letting us all learn more broadly. So thanks for putting this together.
Office Hours is hosted and produced by me, Isaac Brickman. You can follow Office Hours on Instagram at Office Hours Podcast One, YouTube at Isaac from Office Hours, and Blue Sky at Office Hours Podcast. And please subscribe to Office Hours wherever you are listening from.